Okay. I was kind of racing through this excursus last week, kind of as we ended, so I want to just spend a couple minutes to review that as we get started here this morning, and then we get to do what after that? Homework. Anybody do their homework? You guys are exempted because you weren't here last week, so I won't call on you. But yeah, we had homework last week, so we're going to take a look at that. All right, so remember I said there were four parts to a biblical narrative. The first part is the introduction, and in the introduction we see the setting, the location, the characters, kind of the context, if you will, for what the narrative story is going to be. The second part, and usually the longest part of any biblical narrative, is the plot or the storyline. We see the tensions building, we see the actual dilemma or the issue that's being dealt with, all leading towards part three, which is the climax, where the problem is resolved, kind of tensions and emotions de-escalate, and as is typical of biblical narrative, the conclusions are kind of very abrupt, kind of boom, one or two verses maybe, but also oftentimes you see in the conclusions a transition type of sentence as it both wraps up the narrative that preceded and then begins to introduce or transition into the narratives that follow. Okay, so kind of four parts to biblical narrative. This is the part I raced through. A lot of these overlap, so you know I don't think it's critical to get through this part, but there are different types of narratives. One type is tragedy, where we're hearing stories of an individual's decline. So you can think of Samson and Saul as two examples of narratives that kind of follow the tragedy type. There are epics, which are long stories, multiple episodes, kind of like a play that you would even go to. So think of the Book of Numbers as a good example of that, the wilderness wanderings of the Israelite nation as they went through there. There's romance, so courtship between a man and a woman. So of course, Ruth we see as an example of that in our biblical picture of marital love in Song of Songs or Song of Solomon, however you name that book. Heroic, stories built around the life and exploits of a hero figure. Abraham, David, Daniel, just many, many of them. So there's a couple of examples as we go through it. Fifthly, satire, so stories exposing human vice or folly through ridicule or abuse. So Jonah, and then those of you that were at the conference yesterday, Proverbs 1 to 9. I mean, certainly a lot of good teaching in that section. And then finally, polemic or argumentative, an aggressive attack against or refuting the views of others. So two interesting examples of that would be the instance of Elijah with the Baals when he was confronting them, or even the back and forth between Moses and Pharaoh as the plagues were called down on the nation. Okay, so there are different types of narratives. I think this is less important to understand than the basic four parts, okay? But just to give you a little sprinkling of the different types of narratives that we do see in the Old Testament. So, we then had a homework assignment, right? Using Genesis 13, the next narrative, 1 to 18, break down for me the four parts, and then the key part, in a sentence of 18 words or less, tell me what you think the main point is. Now, 18 words, I usually do 15. The point is to be succinct, right? It's not one of these, and then, and then, and then, and then, and then, and then. Only biblical narratives can do that. We have to be more succinct when we get to the main point, all right? So, here we go. Four parts of the story. What do we think comprises the introduction? Anybody want to offer up their take on that? Which verses are in the introduction?
1 to 6.
1 to 6, you say. Okay. What do you have? We have another one. Anybody else?
1 to 5.
1 to 5, okay. David says 1 to 5. We have 1 to 6, 1 to 5. Yeah, Eric?
We went through 1 through 4.
That's good, just so we can have some options.
What you like,
yeah, interesting. Okay, well, it is interesting, actually. I remember the first time I did this, we had a young gal, about 12 or 13 years old. Everybody else was, I'm not saying anything, but she did it as her homeschooling assignment. She did a terrific job, and I actually changed mine after hers. So I think I was at 1 to 4 before.
Right,
was that?
Before.
I was right before. But I think I went back to 1 to 5 after. So why did you go to 1 to 4? What was your thinking on that?
Did we write the notes now? It looked like, yeah, I'm at fault for it.
It's okay.
setting, context?
Yeah, the setting, the context, and the, just the location, so it was sort of setting the stage for what was about to come and not really getting the lesson yet.
Yeah, and 5, 6 kind of seemed like transition.
Start transitioning.
Yeah, and that's the difficult part. You do get those. Now, how about our gentleman with 1 to 6 over here? Why did you stop at 6? What was your thinking?
Well, because I thought the class started at 7.
Okay. Okay, David, why'd you hit on 5?
Well, I think 1 to 4 makes sense because it says now.
Right.
But it says a lamb cannot sustain them, so that's kind of the problem. But really, you could argue 5, 6, or 7 increases the plot.
Yeah. So it is interesting. I think any of those are fair answers, 4, 5, or 6, as we go through it. I came down on 1 to 5, okay, once I went through it. And why did I say that? Now, Lot, okay, so Abram went there, da-da-da. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock, da-da-da-da. Yeah, so my logic in including 5 was that's where we see Lot introduced. Okay, so we get the second character. So that's why I would have included 5 in the introduction. We learned the other main person in that. And then 6, I think you can still argue that because you still get a bit of context there and the land. But you're starting to transition in verse 6 to that break between the two. Okay, so.
The problem statement.
What's that?
6 is you start with the problem.
Yeah, I think 6 is the problem statement. I think where you start to get the basic point. So I would have stopped at 5. I think you can argue 6. A lot, again, as I said, sometimes these verses, and this is one of the beauties of the Bible, you see it a lot in the New Testament, where, and the Old Testament as well, where one verse kind of concludes the first part and kind of introduces the next part. So it closes and introduces and so forth. Okay, so what verses do we have comprising the plot? I know you're going to start at 7, so where do you go from 7 to what?
13.
7 to 13, okay. Eric, what did you guys have?
So we went through 5 to 9.
Yeah.
Because 5 starts introducing Lot, although actually I would want 5, I think it's just
people. Yeah.
And then we go through 9, 7. It's basically, okay, here's the question, here's the problem statement, here's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just setting everything up, like we're setting the stage,
what's going on,
and before we hit the climax.
So okay.
Okay. If it's not the introduction, it's not the climax.
Yeah. We're going to call it the plot. Okay. Hey, David, how about you? Where did you go on that?
I think the resolution kind of comes when Abram defers to Lot.
The resolution. Okay. So now where were that?
8 and 9.
So you're right. You would be then with Eric, kind of in that same spot. You'd go somewhere around 8 and 9 is kind of the... Your 5, 6 to 9 or so
right. Would
be your plot line. Okay. Well, this time I'm going to concur with my age gentleman here. I went to 13, okay. And again, I want to say that as we do interpretation of the Bible, right, the words do mean one thing and one thing only. On that, there's no hedging, okay. Outlining, that's not inspired. Okay, people can see different kind of scenarios and transitions. I took it through 13, and the reason why is really comes to the next part. To me, kind of the high point of the story and the climax is when God shows up. Okay, so that's kind of, we're still seeing the whole scenario. We haven't seen the resolution. We're seeing the plot playing out through those scenarios, right? So we have the problem, okay? Then we learn how Lot chooses, right? Okay? And so, all right, so it's still kind of building. He chooses, he goes this way. But then I kind of picked up 14 as the beginning of the climax because now all of a sudden we have a new player on the scene, right? It's like he's not introduced in the introduction, but all of a sudden, whoop, God shows up. So that's kind of an interesting scenario. So I chose to go through 6 to 13. So then verses comprising the climax, what do you guys have for that? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Look. I think these are okay. I mean, I think you can have different approaches to this and kind of where you see the different breaks and things like that. And some of it's stylistic. I mean, what do you see and how do you see it?
14 to 17.
Okay. Man's hitting around all cylinders right there. He's getting the gold star. What do you have, David?
I agree.
Okay, so I came to 14 to 17 as well. I think for me, the kind of climax is when God shows up. And this is where we get a bit of the moral of the story, okay? So we'll move through that and take a look at it in terms of how that plays out. And then, of course, that just leaves us with verse 18 as the conclusion.
I was going to answer that one.
Okay, well, you had them all so far. I just assumed you had that one. I had your back on that. All right, well, look, I appreciate you guys taking time to think it through. It's helpful, okay? And, you know, we all have our own prejudices in terms of how we deal with Scripture. The way I was taught and what I was struck by a lot, I had an Old Testament professor who was my first professor, and he was just an outliner. I mean, he just outlined things, and for me, he could make the Bible come alive. It was helpful for me to outline things. It's helpful for me to kind of see main points as I move through things and try to understand how an argument. Now, in the New Testament, it's generally a lot easier because you're generally dealing with a paragraph. And there's one main idea in the paragraph, and you're going to have some supporting arguments for the main idea. It's not necessarily easy to pick out the main idea, but generally you have kind of a paragraph structure for those things. In the Old Testament, when you have these longer stories and narratives, it's a little harder. I mean, you've got to work at it a little harder, and you've got to think through kind of how they connect themselves together. So that is way. Now, how about a... what did it mean? Kind of thinking first, what did it mean to them? Did anybody kind of come up with a statement on what you thought it meant or what the message was here? Yeah, come on.
Okay, I use 13 words. God provides abundantly for those who love and obey him. Abram did both.
Okay, that's good. I like that. So that's not only a what does it mean? But that's really a good homiletical statement. Okay, so remember when I talked about the process? You know, whenever any of the pastors you hear speaking here, they're going to start with this hermeneutic, that's your science or your process of interpretation. Then there's exegesis when they're actually applying that those principles. And then you got to take it into language that you talk to people with, right? Not the crazy little silly technical stuff. And so that's kind of the homiletical thing. So I think he had a good homiletical statement. Did you guys take a crack at it?
Six words, although maybe God promised land and descendants to Abram.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. David, did you take a crack at that or not?
This is it, Abram.
This is it, Abram. You guys are good. I couldn't get it down. That's pretty good. You know, it is hard, by the way. So I compliment you on that. It's hard to get it down. Sue?
When I was reading it this morning, as I confessed to you.
That's okay. And you're forgiven.
The thing that struck me was, I just wrote, love the Lord your God and your neighbor as yourself, because Abram loved God, and his neighbor in this case was his brother, nephew, Lot.
Yeah, okay.
So he just obeyed.
Yeah. Now, see, that's an interesting one, okay? So here's where it gets kind of tricky when you're doing these things. I would say that's a terrific implication, okay, of the text, right? I'm not sure it's the main idea he was trying to get across, but it's a great implication of that principle, okay? And that's why, by the way, I got to say, implication is really hard. I don't do it very well, okay? Other of our pastors do it very, very well. It's really hard to do good implication because you're driving at the heart issue, okay? So I would say that that's probably more of an implication of the text, right? But not necessarily his main idea. What did he want you to come away with, okay? So again, I think all three of these guys kind of captured it. The only difference between the then and the now is a past tense and a present tense statement, okay? So I just come to the bottom. So here's how I said it. God uses conflict to grow our faith and reaffirm our blessings, okay? So pretty close to this one here. Read yours again.
God provides abundantly for those who love and obey him. Abram did both.
Okay, so see, blessings, kind of see that. He's kind of reaffirming blessings, doing kind of scenarios. So, yeah, it's good. I think you guys all got it. In different ways, you kind of got to the key point here, which is what was God doing through this conflict? What message was he trying to convey through the process, okay? And indeed, Abram did do both, okay? So, you know, through these first two instances of his faith being tested, right? First one, he kind of didn't do so well. We'll conclude this one. We'll find out, okay, his faith is growing. He did better. He understood much better how to respond to this particular instance of conflict. And then we're going to see crisis, okay? He did even better there. But then, as soon as he does good, he's going to fall back off the cliff as we keep going again. All right. Well, that's good. So, look, I hope that you can kind of just think about this stuff as you're going through and reading. It's a good way as you're reading a piece of text. If you're, you know, just doing a devotional section or you're reading a piece and you're reading in the morning, take a moment to just kind of sit down and jot down. So, you know, oftentimes, I like these read through the Bible programs. I think they're good, but I think oftentimes they start to become, did I get my verses done today? Versus saying, okay, let me just take whatever I have here and stop and think about it and actually meditate on it a bit, kind of see what's he saying, what's the main point. And you can use these principles as you're looking at your text and as you're spending your time in the Word. And as you then tune yourself to it more and more, I think you'll just see more and more come alive, okay? You'll get a sense of what they're trying to say, how they're trying to say it, and then you can start drawing implications from it from your life, okay? So thank you for doing your homework. I appreciate it. And so far, we've taken a look at Chapter 12, the introductory part where Abram's faith is inaugurated in verses 1 to 9. Oh, I'm sorry.
I know you said earlier that you thought, I'm just going to put a different thought out here.
Sure.
From a little different angle.
Disagreement's not allowed in here.
I know you said earlier that you thought when God told Abram at the time to leave his family.
Right.
That he took Lot with him.
Right.
You thought that was part of, okay.
Yeah, what I said is I didn't think he was being disobedient to that at that point.
But if you look at it from a perspective that he should have left Lot behind.
Yeah.
That he actually disobeyed God in the process. Mm-hmm. You would come away with a different conclusion about what happens here because the word Lot means pebble.
Mm-hmm.
You ever try to walk around with a pebble?
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's fair.
What you see here, actually, I think, is that the start of the problem of taking somebody along that God told you to leave behind.
Right.
If you carry it to this logical conclusion, you see all the things that happen.
Because yeah.
Lot, he's going to have to rescue him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Lot ends up incest with
yeah.
his daughters.
Yeah.
And you have Moab and Ammon.
Yeah.
And all the problems. That
yeah, no, look, I think that's
so,
a fair...
So I'm just
yeah.
going...
No, that's a fair comment. Very fair. You know... I was just trying to say I don't think he was actively disobedient. Now, did he fully obey in the process? Probably not. And but your point is a good one because why do we keep seeing these narratives where Lot's at the center, right? And your point. I mean, and I like the pebble in your shoe idea. It's a good way to do the gospel, by the way. Just stick pebbles in people's shoes and they walk around. Oh, that hurts. That hurts. You know, you're not going to convince anybody. The Holy Spirit does that. We're just there to help people. But it's a good point. I mean, why is Lot at the center of all these things? So I would draw an implication that I think is fair on your part, which is when you don't fully obey the full intention of God's desire in his instructions to you, you're going to have consequences. And we see these consequences playing out. Yeah. So I think it's fair. And I think you can go either way on that. I mean, you could say
yeah,
that that's so. Active disobedience, or you
a
could say that.
I agree totally what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I would even pull back what I said. I wouldn't be so dogmatic to say. I was just trying to convey it wasn't an active disobedience. But, you know, I had a little illustration for the kids yesterday on their obedience. And I talked about the actual actions of obedience and the attitude of obedience, right? So your parents ask you to do something, you know, and you say, okay, I'll do it. And you stomp off with a little pouty face, right? Well, that's not really obedience, okay? So... similar scenario, I think, is fair in that regard, and yeah, so I think it's a good point. Those kind of inputs are always welcome in this class, by the way, all my teasing aside.
It's tough when it comes to your family, you know.
Yeah.
Do things sometimes here.
Well, you know, here's the thing. So in ancient Near East society, and even you're saying it here, see, Katie, my wife, and Cayenne, they're from an Eastern culture. They get it. They understand family way differently than we do here in the West. So in that culture, when a parent died, you would have assumed responsibility for their children, okay? So it's Abram's growth as he goes through it. So there's a lot of things that are playing into it. But yeah, it's a fair comment. I agree with you. Why is Lot so much at the center of these troubles? Well, when you're not fully obeying what God says, it's probably going to come back, I'd say bite you in the rear end, but since you got the pebble in the shoe, that's probably a little more socially correct. We'll go with the pebble in the shoe analogy. You're going to have some pebbles in your shoes, and you're going to feel those kind of things over and over again. So, yeah, it's a good comment, so thank you for sharing that. So, introducing in chapter 12, then, Abram's faith is inaugurated. Okay, so he called him, and we see Abram's response. Then we're seeing Abram's faith refined over these next chapters, from 12:10 all the way through the end of chapter 14. Last week we saw the first one. We saw it being refined through circumstances, right? The circumstances of no food and how he responded to that circumstance of everyday life. This week we're going to take a look at these other two instances, okay? So through our conflicts with others, God used conflicts with others to help refine our faith. And then ultimately at times we're going to face real crises in our life. And I do use the word plural here because when we get to chapter 14, we will not get through it all today because there are multiple crises that happen as we move through that particular narrative. Okay, so in chapter 13, we're going to encounter the next obstacle. As with the preceding one, is intended to test and grow his faith. Now, the other thing we do see, though, as we're being tested, it's not just about our faith. It's God revealing his character and his attributes and the various things he does as he tests us. So in 12, we had this circumstance, insufficient food. And now in the conflict, we're going to have insufficient land. Okay, so not enough food, not enough land. Kind of regular, everyday types of things. So, someone read for me, please, the first five verses of chapter 13.
I can do it.
Okay.
So, Abram went from Egypt to the calf, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and not with him. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and gold. He went on his journeys from Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning. Between Bethel and Ai to the place with the altar which he had made there formerly. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents.
Okay, so first five verses. So we're basically getting the introduction to the narrative here. The main characters are introduced, right? The main characters are Abram and Lot. The context is introduced at this point. So first of all, they're on their return journey, right? So they were down here in Egypt. They had the first conflict. They're moving back through this area called the Negev, is the wilderness. It's prominent in the book of Exodus as we hear about the wilderness wanderings, desert area. So he's on his return journey. And the setting ultimately is going to be between Bethel and Ai. So remember when he came into the land first, he landed in Shechem. Then he went to Bethel and Ai. That's where he built his second altar and worship the Lord. And Abram worships the Lord and calls on the name of the Lord again. So we see this pattern with Abram, okay? He is reflective on who is leading him and guiding him in the process. And then further context in verse 5, which is why I included 5 in this point, is we get some sense of what's going on. Both of them had a lot of material possession, flocks, and we also learn they have this little word, and tents, which is likely to imply that Lot, as well as Abram, had compiled people, perhaps servants, extended family. So we've got two kind of individuals, both with a lot of material possession in terms of their flocks, and both with a number of people that are associated with them. So that's our setting. They're back there. Now, 6 to 13, somebody please. This side's doing so well. Let's have somebody read from this side over here. Okay, so. Go ahead.
And the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling with them in the land. So Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right. Or if to the right, then I will go to the left." Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley, and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly, and sinners against the Lord.
Okay, so now we're getting into the whole plot line of the story. So the plot line starts with the dilemma, which is introduced in verses 6 and 7. So they had insufficient grazing lands, and this was producing conflict between the various shepherds that each of them had that were tending the flocks, okay? So that's where the conflict started. Now, what's the point of the final clause in verse 7? I mean, we're talking about Abram and Lot. Why do they add in this phrase, now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land? What's the point of that being added in there? The story's not going to hinge on this answer.
They were
what?
They were foreigners.
Yeah, foreigners. I think that's one good perception, kind of a reinforcement of the fact that they were foreigners in the land. Any other thoughts?
Just the fact that there wasn't a lot of room because they were there already.
Yeah, okay. I think that's probably the more primary, but I think both of those are good examples, right? So the fact is the constant reminder that the land hasn't really been given to them yet. They are foreigners. But to heighten, I think, the issue of the shortage, right? So it's not just that they're there with their flocks and their people, but there are all the inhabitants of the land that were already there. So, you know, there was a genuine shortage in this particular area of the land. So it was not just Abram and his herds, but also the fact that there were already occupants in the land. So the Canaanites and the Perizzites themselves, I don't think, are terribly important to the story, just simply the fact that, yeah, this was a significant issue, and it would create strife amongst the different people. Now, continues with Abram's appeal to Lot, in verse 8 and the first part of verse 9. Now, the appeal's kind of interesting. He uses a strong exhortation. I don't know how it's translated in your Bible. It's probably please if you're looking at a New American Standard. But it's a Hebrew particle called na, and it's basically really more of a command than it is a kind of, you know, a nicety. We hear the word please and we think of it as a nicety. Back in the Hebrew language, basically he's saying, hey, look, let there be no strife between you and me. So he's strongly making an appeal. The brothers in verse 8, I think, is understood as familial. Okay, so don't think of that as kind of a brotherhood of Christians at this point in time. They are brothers in a familial sense. And then Abraham starts with a rhetorical question to introduce his proposal. And what he's effectively saying here is, look, we don't need to fight over the land. So he kind of brings it along in the narrative in that regard. Now, his proposed solution is in 9b. Now, I think this is where I can go back to my brother's point here earlier, because God is going to get what he wants ultimately, because he wants them apart, right? So now we see that the proposal is for them to separate, okay? So this is really what the whole command was back at the beginning. But then we get kind of the first surprising part of the story. Abram says, you choose first, okay? Now, what's strange or shocking about that approach? What is interesting about that?
Abram is the elder.
Yeah, okay? Abram, by every right, is the superior. Okay, but what we see here is the superior deferring to the inferior one in terms of hierarchical structure of the family, right? So what do you learn, or what can we learn? What's an implication for us of Abram's approach here? What can we learn from the way he approaches this?
He was really trusting God. God had given him the land, and he was like, you know, just let God.
Yeah, no, actually, I think that's the big answer to the process. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so basically he's saying be willing to subordinate your self-interest. Okay, now it's building. Okay, and I think Linda's right. This is where we're going to get to ultimately. You know, I'll have the question later. The answer is exactly what she said, which is Abram wasn't sweating the small stuff. God had already told him it was all going to be his. Okay, so we are seeing faith and trust. Okay, so we're seeing Abram's faith growing, but right here in his first approach to the resolving the conflict is he didn't put his own self-interest first, okay? Now, that's a pretty good principle for conflict resolution, isn't it? Because where do we usually start? What about me? You know, hey, you did this, you did that. You know, we don't start that way. You know, how many of you in your conflicts start with, you know, maybe there's something I could have done better. What would that have been, honey? Any of you use that general line? Yeah. Every once in a while, I have a stroke of genius and remember it, but not often. Generally, it's something kind of throwing or a little bone, but then the most important word in the English language, which is but, with one T. Okay? Right? Because what do we listen to in a sentence? Whatever comes after but. Right? Honey, you're so beautiful, you know, and this is so lovely, but when do you think her ears pick up? I said, okay, here's where we're getting the real message now. Okay? So it's interesting. Putting your own self-interest first. I mean, putting somebody else's self-interest first and subordinating yours, I think, is a good principle. Voluntarily giving up our right to be right, right? And then thirdly, maybe now to Linda's one, relying on God to defend or protect our interest, right? I mean, this is really, I think, the key point. When you're in conflict, do you think God knows what's going on? Yeah, answer to that's always yes, right? You go to one of the O's, right? He knows everything. So, yeah, he knows. So the conflict's there for a reason. So why don't we rely on God and see how he's going to take us through the process? Okay, so Lot's choice in verses 10 to 11, right? So he's deferred to Lot. Go ahead, Lot, you choose. Now, how does Lot choose? What do we see about how Lot chooses here in verses 10 to 11? What's kind of the characteristic of his choosing?
He puts himself first.
Yeah, puts himself first, for sure, absolutely. Which means who's second and who's third? Yeah. And who's third?
I guess God.
Yeah, to guess God. We don't know that he's a believer at this point, right? This will be one of my big questions at the end of this section, right? But yeah, okay, so he certainly chooses devoid of God, right? What else does he do?
Based on his experience with famine, he kills.
Yeah, exactly, right? He's relying on his own self-interest in the process, okay? So with self-interest and human insight, devoid of God, and then noting the sequence, okay? What did he do? He lifted up his eyes and he engaged his senses, right? So this is what he did. He saw something that approximated the beauty of the Garden of Eden. That's what it says, right? Like the Garden of God. It's beautiful, right? He says, that's got to be the place to go, right? Pretty natural when you think about it, right? The grazing was good, the perfect place. So, what is the heart of the issue in the sequence here? What is the heart? What's going on, do you think, in Lot's heart right here? One word.
Greed.
Greed, yeah, okay. And where would greed come from?
Lust.
One what?
Lust.
Yeah, okay. How about this one? Desire, right? Okay, this is a root. You know, we have old Timothy, you know, money is the root of many evils, not every evil, okay? Well, I got to tell you, desire is probably at the root of pretty much everything to do. You're going to see something. So look at the sequence, right? He looked, he saw, he wanted, he desired, okay? It gets to the heart every time pretty quickly. He desired that particular thing. So what does his sequence remind you of? Does it remind you of anybody? Huh?
David.
Yeah, David. How about one? We haven't seen David yet, but how about one before that?
Eve.
How about Eve? Okay, right, Kat. Go back to Genesis 3. Go back to Genesis 3. And we'll look at the sequence. You know, one through five, you're kind of getting the process, the back and forth with the serpent. But then we see the process, right? Verse 6. When the woman what?
Saw,
okay, so she looked that the tree was good for food, and that was a delight to the eyes, okay, and that the tree was what?
Desirable.
Okay, to make one wise. What'd she do? Grabbed it, had a bite, say, hey, honey, this is good fruit. Have a little bit along with me, okay? So the fact of the matter is that you see this sequence in sin, okay, and this is, I think, the sequence that we see. You can see it here with Eve. Achan, we see that same sequence with him. Remember when he kind of fouled up the whole group, right? Because they told him don't take any of this stuff. What did he do? He saw, he looked at it. Same sequence again. Exact same sequence with David, right? And if we think about our own lives, I think we can probably all think of examples of that, right? So the eyes are the gateway to the heart. That's why we have to guide the eyes. Now the men, we got to guide our eyes in certain ways, and women have to guide their eyes in other ways. But the fact is, we all have these gateways, and these gateways open up desires in our heart. Now, can you think, though, of an Old Testament circumstance where somebody looked but then decided in a much more godly way? Can you think of an example of somebody who did that more positively? Joseph, yeah, that's a great one. I like Joseph. I didn't thought about that one. You know, you meant it for evil, and God meant it for good. That's kind of, I think, one of the most amazing statements of all of Genesis. Another one, a whole book, short little book. Ruth, right? What did she do? What do we do there? She said, no, 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 stay here. Stay back with these guys. You know, there's nothing. I got nothing for you back home. But she said, no, no, I want to go with you. I want to follow you. So she saw with much different kinds of eyes. Okay, so it really is something you have to train yourself to do. And it's something you have to short circuit. If you don't short circuit this thing, it spins, okay, and you go down through the process. So Lot chooses the fertile valley of the Jordan, north and east of the Dead Sea. There's a lot of debate about where this is. Some people think Sodom and Gomorrah is kind of at the southern end of the Dead Sea. Others think it's kind of at the northeast corner of the Dead Sea. The true answer is only one person knows, and it's none of us that are humans, okay? So there was a real place, and he looked and saw that process. Okay, aftermath, verse 12, okay? Abram settles in the land of Canaan, right? That's the promised land. Lot settles in the cities of the valley, okay, making home base as far as, which means next to, Sodom. So apparently, it was more than just the grazing land. I think there was probably something about the lifestyle that he saw in Sodom and Gomorrah that attracted him as well, right? It was a city. It was more developed, right? Green acres. Green acres. Here we come. Oh, I want city life, okay? So he wanted city life, okay? So what's the folly of his choice, right? What's the folly of Lot's choice here, ultimately?
He chose to live right next to this sinful, wretched place.
Right.
Thinking he wasn't going to be tainted or something.
Yeah, exactly right. He put himself at risk, right? He just put himself at risk. Here's the point. You can't flirt with sin, right? You just can't, right? It always consummates at some point in time. So he just put himself unnecessarily at risk in the process, okay? So that's really the ultimate folly of his choice. He didn't just pick what he thought. Look, anybody with a right mind would look and say, yeah, it's better grazing land. If you're giving me the choice, I'm going there, right? But did he go there and pitch his tents out in the wilderness and stay away from trouble? No, he not only went there, he went and associated himself with the city. We're going to learn a lot more about the city as we keep going through the narrative here. So you see that whole process. So, implications, okay? And again, I think it's back to my brother's comment here. You know, ultimately God is going to accomplish his purposes despite our choices, right? So now finally, he's gotten these two guys apart, right? He's got Abram where he wants them as he started in the process. Point of the story was not a choice between good or barren land, but rather the nature of godly and ungodly decision-making in decisions and resolving conflicts, okay? So that's really the point of the story. It isn't whether you pick good land or bad land. It's with how did he go about making the decision, and how did Abram go about making the decision? So we see with Abram a very godly choice this time. We see with Lot a continued ungodly choice. It's easy to overlook temptation and the sin around us in our decision making, okay? So it really is easy to do that. You have to be conscious of thinking about these things. I don't think we have to run through life scared, but I do think we need to think about our decisions much more deliberately when we're going through things. And then finally, we should never become complacent about or immune to how surrounding sin will impact us, right? You hang out around sin, I'm pretty much going to say you're going to fall into it, right? If you put yourself in those positions, if you expose yourself to it, you are going to succumb to it at some point in time. So being deliberate about associating yourself with Christian brotherhood, non-sinful behavior is an important part about the choices we make. Now, as we kind of concluded, a big question for me as I go through this is what to make of Lot, right? So what do we make of Lot? I mean, it doesn't look like a very savory character, right? But yet, Peter identifies him as a believer, right? So just look at 2 Peter quickly. Turn there, 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 7. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7. Peter says this, 2 Peter 2, verse 7, And if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men. So, it looks like that Peter thinks he's a believer, right? And it looks like, he was just kind of a victim. So it's hard for me to get a handle around this guy Lot. At his best, he's a superficial believer, right? Governed by selfish and worldly behavior, yet God does preserve him, right? He's going to preserve him as we get to chapter 14. He's going to preserve him again as we get to chapter 19. So clearly, he's part of God's plan. Just kind of some of the things that occur to my mind as I go through it. All right, somebody read verses 14 to 17 as we keep going here.
And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk around the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you.
Okay, so in my opinion, this is where we see the conflict. It starts with, the climax, and it starts with this surprise visitor, okay? So it's the main point of the story, and we already talked about it, so we don't have to go through the what is it, which is exercising divine sight reaffirms God's blessings, okay? So as we respond well to the things that God puts into our life, we can expect God's blessing. Now, this is not a formula, okay? Not saying God always gives us a reward when we do things well, but clearly as you look at books like Deuteronomy where it says, hey, be obedient and what? Get blessed. And disobedient, what? Get cursed. Now, how much time is spent on obedience? This much. How much time is spent on disobedience in that section? This much. So probably a reflection of kind of where we spend most of our time. But yet the idea here is that as we're exercising God's prerogative and God's sight in things, it gives him a chance to reaffirm his blessings to us. And I'm using this word reaffirm, okay? Not necessarily give us new blessings, but reaffirm the things he's already given us. So apparently Abram had recalled and believed God's promise last time he showed up about the land. And in the bottom line, we see his faith is growing. Okay, he responds well to the trial, which leads to an implication in the rest of the story, right? So as we respond in faith, God can and will reaffirm. But also what goes on here is he reveals further blessings, okay? And this is what he does with Abram in 14 to 17. So he reaffirms his previous promises, but he also starts to reveal more detail. So what's some of the additional detail that we see in verses 14 to 17? Remember, he's already told him he's going to have a land, right? So now what do we start to see here in 14 to 17? We start to get some more details. What can you pick out? Right? Okay, so what's the key part of that sentence then? What word are you focusing on?
Forever.
Forever, good. Right, okay. So we see something about eternality. All right, we hadn't heard that before. Okay, that's new. So this is an eternal type of thing. What else do you see?
Descendants won't be able to be numbered.
Yeah, right. Innumerable. Now, think what that sounds like to Abram's ears. Right? How many has he got so far? Zippo. Right? And it's not looking good. Right? So, and you're going to have, he uses hyperbole here, right? More than the sands, right? Seriously? You've been to the beach? Well, I've got red tide. I guess we're not going to the beach right now, but pick up a handful of sand, right? That's a lot. Okay, so you see those things. What else? Okay, so he reaffirms his unconditional covenant is one thing we see. Notice again all the I wills, I wills, I wills. Okay, so that's kind of some of the reaffirmation again. So we see the unconditional nature of the covenant reaffirmed. He reaffirms Abram's responsibility. Right at the end, he says, what does he say? Get up or arise and walk around. Okay, so in other words, go. Same thing that we saw back in 12. He further reveals the extent of the land, right? So now he's saying, hey, look north, look east, look north, look south, look east, look west. Okay, so all this is going to be yours. So he kind of gives him some sense of the extent of the land. the duration, which Sue got, the eternal nature, the extent of the progeny, which Linda brought up, okay, using hyperbole, it'll be innumerable. That's a tongue twister. Okay, and then finally we get to the conclusion in verse 18. I'll go ahead and read that. It'll be my big contribution to the morning here. A reading, then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, where he built an altar to the Lord. Okay, so just kind of, Hebron is just a little bit further south down here. So Bethel and Ai are right in here. Hebron a little bit further south. That was kind of a key home base for Abram in his process. All right, so that takes us through the second scenario. We'll see how far we get into the next one. We will not get to the final part for sure, because that's got a lot we've got to take a look at. So kind of pulling back out high level, we've seen his faith inaugurated, right? 12:1-9. Then we saw his faith refine, first circumstances, now a conflict, right? So we're seeing Abram growing in his faith. He's moving along. He's responding in a more godly manner. And then finally, now we're going to have this crisis, okay? In chapter 14:1-24. And there actually are going to be two crises, I would say even maybe three, in this process that are kind of leading him through the whole thing. Okay, so the first one is Lot. Then it's, what do I do about Lot? And then the third crisis, which is kind of a little interesting, is when we get to this last part, we kind of see a new figure come into the game, right? Who's the new figure that comes in at the end of 14? Somebody whispered it, and I didn't hear it very loud.
Melchizedek,
okay? So we see this new figure that comes in at the end of chapter 14. And you're going to see kind of an interesting new conflict at the end, or crisis of worship, right? And so we'll see how Abram responds to that. So let's get started and see how far we can get. Somebody read the first four verses for me, please. That's where the crisis is introduced. Chapter 14:1-4. Go ahead, Sue. You tried last time.
Okay. And it came, yeah, I get the tongue twister. It came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemember, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these came as allies to the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years after they had served Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled.
All right. We all got to give her a hand for that. That was pretty good with all those names. Okay. That's good. Good for you. Cheddar, it's not. It's actually Ked is how you pronounce it. Chedorlaomer. Okay. But you did great on all of them. Thank you very much. That's a hard one to read. Okay. So what do we see? Two combatants, right? So there's two armies. There's one from the east and there's one from the west. So we have this consortium of kings here, right, in the east. And then we have this consortium of kings from Babylon over in the west, right? So two armies, right? The catalyst for the problem that's going to come about, we get in chapter and verse 4, and that is that the eastern armies have been paying tribute to these western kings for a period of 12 years, and they decided that enough was enough. They weren't going to pay anymore. Okay? So Abram's crisis is then initialized. Somebody read verses 5 to 10. Okay.
Came and defeated the Rephaim in Ascaroth Carnaim, and the Zuim of Ham and Emim in Shadeth Kirathaim, and the Horites in Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishap, which is Kadesh, and conquered all the country of the Amalekites and the Amorites who lived in Hazon Tamar. And the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out and arrayed for battle against them in the valley of Siddim, against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of harlots, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. And they fell into them, but those who survived fled into the hill country.
Now, when you're learning to translate Hebrew, passages like this are great because there's lots of repetition. So once you get the first part, you're going to get the second part. But when we're reading them in English, it's hard. So again, thank you for trying to work through those names. But, you know, it is interesting the level of detail we get, right? You know, people always say, well, God didn't tell us this or he didn't tell us that. Well, he does give us a lot of detail about the things he wants us to know. So these are really establishing historical people and historical places, which gives veracity to the Bible. One of my favorite archaeological lines is, the more we dig up, the more we prove the Bible right. Right? So everybody thinks that these things aren't there or weren't there, and then we dig more things up, and what do we find? Well, indeed, they were there. So it adds, I think, a level of confidence to the Bible. Okay, so now the crisis is introduced, right? The Western army pursues retribution. Very natural response. They weren't paying their tribute anymore, so they went and came after them. It was an extensive campaign. They subdued a lot more than just the rebellious coalition. So I guess they figured, look, if we're going to go fight these guys, let's knock off these other guys on the way, too, so just to make sure we don't have any problem with them. Any number of questions as to why they did it, but it's just simply preparing us for what's going to come later. Okay? So they came, they attacked, and we begin to learn the process. Now, Abram's crisis is identified in verses 11 and 12. So somebody read those, please. Verses 11 and 12, we see the crisis identified.
So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way.
Okay, so it isn't the fact that they defeated Sodom and Gomorrah. It isn't the fact that they took all their stuff and went away. The crisis is now his nephew Lot. Here we go again. Good old Lot back in the picture. That pebble's turning into a boulder. Right? Okay? So he is then the source of the problem. So this is the crisis, right? Two crises arise from the spoils. The first is in verse 11 and 12, and then again in 21 and following, we'll see another one. But here's where we get the problem, or the dilemma, and that is Lot's been taken captive, right? So what's Abram to do? All right? Lot's been taken captive. So what is he to do? All right, so let's see what his response is. So I'm going to read 13 to 16.
Then a fugitive came and told Abram in Hebrew. Now he was living by the oaths of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and those were with. And these were allies with Abram. And Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive. He led out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. He brought back all the goods. He also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions, and also the women and people.
Okay, so 13 to 16 open up a new act in the drama, and we also get a new set of characters. Okay, so this is a compound narrative. We saw the first part, and now we're seeing more people introduced, kind of like a second act. New characters. The first is the informant that comes and lets them know, hey, your nephew, he's been taken. The second is Abram, of course, the Hebrew, so he's given his ethnic designation. Again, I think just calling out that he's not a natural part of the land at this point. And then the third are Abram's allies by means of a treaty, okay, or literally a covenant. So these brothers, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, who are brothers, and they are Amorites, okay, so he's made a treaty with these guys. Now, Abram musters his forces and heads out, right? So he's got 318 able-bodied men in his group. So maybe Abram's not working things out, but somebody's working things out because he's compiled now in his family, born to him, 318 people. Okay, so this is his kind of loyal and dependable core. And no mention really of the force size that is contributed by his partners, just simply that they went with him. Certainly they probably brought men along to fight as well. Now, what's notable about Abram's response? What do we know? What kind of have a couple of features notable about his response?
We went in pursuit.
Yeah, okay. So look for the obvious answer. He's sacrificial for sure, right? And courageous, right? So he goes. He doesn't think a lot about it. You know, I don't know, let me pray about it for a few more days. No, you know, he doesn't necessarily consult God, so I kind of wonder that. But we do see some positive attributes. He's sacrificial for sure. He pursues a vastly superior force, right? And he subjects himself now to retaliation, right? So he's just hanging out at Hebron right now. Nobody's bothering him. But by going after these guys, he's going to bring himself to their attention and do that. But he doesn't consult God. Now, why does he do it? All right? I'm going to give you a bunch of speculation. I'm not really sure I know the answer. Duty. So Lot is family. So maybe it's just a duty type of decision. Maybe he still thinks Lot's going to be his heir. Okay? So he's not quite clear yet. He hasn't had an heir of his own, so that's possible. Maybe he hopes Lot's learned his lesson and he'd be ready to repent and rejoin the team. Okay, maybe this is good. He's got his head on straight now. He had experienced God's provision and assumed he would prevail. That's certainly fair. He went down to Egypt, got himself in trouble. God bailed him out there. The really point is we don't know and we can't know. So in fact, I think any of the reasons are plausible, but it leads me to a different conclusion. And that is his motive is not important, but rather his mindset and his attitude is what God is trying to call our attention to. So whatever his motive was, he's trying to call attention to his mindset and his attitude. So what should we note about his mindset? What would you, I mean, how do you think about what Abram did in this process? Yeah.
Well, something really struck me as we were reading this, and that was that Lot, he was near Sodom, but all of a sudden now he's in Sodom. Mm-hmm. Abram is still where God told him to go.
Right.
So one drifted one way and Abram stayed faithful. So I would say his mindset is he's still obedient.
Yeah, okay, his mind is here. But now his mindset, and that's a good attribute. I mean, it's good recognition that he did that. But Abram's mindset in pursuing, okay, what's he really thinking about in doing that? I mean, I gave you all these potential motives. We can't really know from the scenario what the motives are. Yeah?
I was just thinking back earlier there, we were talking about the little phrase there, the Canaanites and Perizzites living in the land, that they were arguing about. You know, the fact the land can support both of them. And the thought that came to my mind was actually what it says in the New Testament about the world will know that we're Christ's disciples by the love we have for each other.
Mm-hmm.
If his mindset was that we don't need to be arguing because we got these unsaved people, if you find that term, living around us here, and if they see we're fussing and fighting.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a good testimony for God.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a pretty good thought.
If he carries that same mindset forward, these same people will be able to see he's not holding a grudge against Lot.
Yeah.
Because you know, he could well say, be spiritual, and say he's reaping what he sowed.
Okay. All right. I think he nailed it, actually.
So anyway.
Yeah, no, I think he nailed it. It's perfect. So in 13, he subordinated his what? His self-interest. Now he's subordinating what? His self-satisfaction. Okay. He could have just said, okay, what would your mindset have been, right? I think he got to it just perfectly, right? So, serves him right, right? It's probably, now I get some vindication. That knucklehead, he deserves what he got, right? Or maybe, you know, I'll just let him stew for a while, let him feel the pain, and maybe I'll go over there and retrieve him, something like that. Or maybe piously, this must be God's judgment on Lot, right? Okay, this is God's will. All of which makes me think of Romans 12, 17 to 19. We won't go there. You can go there later. But basically God says, let him judge, okay? To the best that we can, be at peace with all men. And I do like the implication that he suggests, right? As Christians, you know, what does it say in John 13, 34, 35? Right? How will they know that you belong to me? By your love for one another. I mean, how we treat one another, how we deal with one another. I think that is a good witness to our Christian faith. So, more evidence, I think, of Abram's maturing faith. He does this, his part, and lets God deal with Lot, which he's going to in chapter 19, right? So, sneak preview, if you won't listen, I'll take you out, firebomb your city, okay? So, you can't go back, all right? Bottom line being that God's really going to go to great lengths to secure his plans and his people. You know, I have to study for this ordination process, and you can pretty much take every Old Testament book as something like God's judgment on his disobedient people, yet his faithfulness to his covenant promises despite their repeated failures. I mean, you can almost use that theme for every Old Testament book. We just see this process over and over and over again, right? But it's true, right? God is going to go to great lengths to secure his plans in his people, and this is really what we see in the whole process. So, battle and victory in verses 15, stealth, he attacks by night, deception, divides his army to make it look bigger. And he finishes. I think that's kind of an interesting thing we overlook, right? It's not like he does it, we do our thing. He finishes. He chases them a long ways away in the process as he goes through it. So, what's the point of all this? What's the point of all this? What is the point of all this? Any ideas?
If Abram was able to do things that wouldn't normally be possible.
Sure.
Because he wasn't alone.
Sure.
God was fighting.
Sure, absolutely. So, okay, we rely on God for the victory, but we have a plan, okay? So, look, he can accomplish way more as we're submitted to God and his plans than we ever can on our own. So what's interesting about verse 16, I'm just going to go quick because I want to wrap up here today. And again, Abram's magnanimity, right? He surely did not need to retrieve the losses of the eastern king. So he not only gets Lot, but he also goes back and gets all the stuff of the eastern kings, and particularly since he wasn't going to keep it, right? So it's interesting that he brought back not only Lot, but he restored and brought back all the spoils that had been taken from his neighbors in that particular area. Okay? Which is going to lead us to 17 to 24, which gets us to this, to be continued. Okay? So we'll pick it up next week at verse 17. Read 17 to 24. Think about that. We're going to spend a lot of time on that, actually, as we're going to spend a lot of time in the first part of chapter 15. There's just a lot going on in those verses. We're going to have to figure out who this guy Melchizedek is. We're going to talk a little bit about these pre-incarnate typology type things, Christophanies, so we'll see some excursus activity there. But there's a lot that is happening. So we've seen the crisis. He's gone. He's gotten him back. He's captured everybody. He's brought the stuff back. And now we're going to see in 17 to 24 the aftermath of it. And yet another crisis arises in the process. Okay? So, Colin, would you close us up in a word of prayer, please?
We just thank you for his preparation and just being able to continue hearing the truth just graciously but very clearly taught and preached this past weekend. We thank you that you are a faithful God as we consider your truth presented throughout the Old Testament. As Steve said, it's just an example not of our ability to obey, but your ability just to condescend to help us understand the truth, to see your graciousness and our need for a Savior. So, Father, just pray as we continue now, go into the sermon time and to sing and to praise and to hear truth preached, that we will humble our hearts, see our own inadequacies, and, Father, just bow to your grace and obey. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank